if you could tell our listeners, give them a brief bio of yourself.
Well, I started out as a scientist, a basic scientist. I was interested in the way atoms and molecules move in liquids and solids. And I got interested in military affairs in part because of the enormous growth in the nuclear arsenals of the United States and the then Soviet Union. And as a result of that interest, I went to Washington to spend some time working for the Congress studying the MX missile at a time when the MX missile was going to be deployed in a system called multiple protective shelters. This was a system where there were many shelters, 4,600 shelters, where 200 missiles would be hidden between them. And the idea was that there would be too many shelters for the Soviet Union to attack, and so they would have to randomly attack shelters, and some percentage of the MX missiles would survive. And there was understandably a lot of concern about this system and opposition to it. And I was involved in a very detailed technical study that advised the Congress on the technical problems, the technical issues. And I enjoyed doing that very much and became convinced that there was a useful role for people who were basically approaching these problems from a technical point of view. I had personal views, but my political views and personal views were irrelevant because I wasn't a political decision maker, but at least I could aid the process by providing people with sound technical information about what choices they might have. And I found that a very interesting role to play, and so I decided to stay on in Washington, and I went to work for the Chief of Naval Operations as a scientific advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. And part of the reason I chose that position was at that time, this was 1982, it looked like the arms race was going to go on forever. There was no clear indication that either the United States or the Soviet Union was going to give up on this nuclear arms race between them. And what I was concerned about is that there were so many nuclear weapons on both sides that I didn't think it would be possible for the United States to base its nuclear weapons in a way that would not eventually lead them to be subject to attack from the Soviet Union. And my concern was that if the United States and Soviet Union bumped into each other and got into a major crisis, if the political leadership on both sides became desperate enough, they might at some point try to attack the other, and they would essentially destroy all of Europe and the northern major powers in the northern hemisphere, and possibly even kill most of the people in the northern hemisphere as a secondary consequence. And I believe that submarines could help avoid this problem. I say help avoid this problem because if a submarine, if it can't be found, which I believe was the case, then there would be no incentive in a crisis for a political decision maker on either side to attack the other to try to destroy enough of the enemy's nuclear weapons to be able to absorb a counterstrike. And so I wanted to really learn about submarines in great detail. And so the Navy was a great opportunity from my point of view. And so I went to the Pentagon. I left the Pentagon 2 years later to go to Stanford University, where I worked with a very distinguished physicist. His name is Sidney Drell, who used to be, before he retired, was the deputy head of the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and also was very interested in national security issues. And Sid and I worked together for about 5 years at Stanford, and then I left Stanford for a faculty position at MIT, where I am today.
As I understand it, your first trial by fire in the media came when you publicly questioned the effectiveness of the U.S. Patriot missiles used against Iraq during Desert Storm.
Yes and no. In 1979, I guess I was in the media because the government went into court and got a restraint order against the Progressive magazine, supposedly because the Progressive magazine was going to publish an article that would give away the secret of the hydrogen bomb. And I filed an affidavit that disputed the government's claim, which got a lot of public attention, partly because it gave explanations that made the government's case look weak, and partly because it was classified when it was received by the court, even though I never had a clearance. And that was my first sort of public confrontation with, in this case, the Carter administration. And after that, I did some work on fires from nuclear attacks when I was at Stanford that was published by the National Institutes of Medicine in Washington. And that caused a lot of controversy because I pointed out that there was a problem with the way the United States thinks about and plans civil defense for nuclear weapons attacks. And since that was a big program at that time, it caused a lot of public interest. And after I left Stanford, I got involved in this Patriot controversy, although there were several other things in between where there was some amount of public attention. But the Patriot thing was certainly the one where there was a very, very high level of public attention.
Okay, and it seems somewhat relevant now since the U.S. is massing its military back in that region again. Do you have somewhat of a sense of deja vu seeing this happen again?
Well, I do, although I'm not sure it's going to play out quite the same way that it did during the Gulf War of 91, although I could be wrong. In the Gulf War of 91, first of all, there was a strong sense that the United States may not maintain itself as the global economic giant it obviously is. I don't think that was based in a rational judgment, but we had a slow economy, and the Japanese economy was doing very well at that time, and people were worried that we were going to become a second-class power. This was everywhere in the public discussion. Ridiculous, but there. And then we had this Gulf War, which resulted in this extraordinary military victory with very low casualties, and we didn't have much information about what actually occurred in the air war and certainly in the ground war, but we had all of these images of patriots seemingly knocking down Scuds in the sky, and for reasons that are, I think, explainable in psychological and social terms rather than technical terms, people made the Patriot a symbol of the high-tech stature of the United States. So when I began raising questions about the performance of the Patriot in the Gulf War, which I did actually quite innocently, not realizing what I was walking into, a lot of people saw me as throwing dirt on the flag. It was seen as an incredible insult to the country itself, which was not what I intended to do. It was simply to say, wait a second, this thing did not function as people claimed, and lives are going to depend on this thing in the future if you think it's working, and we have to rethink this.
One of the things that you revealed was that the Patriots actually had an incredibly high failure rate.
Yeah, the initial claim of success rate was given by the Army in congressional testimony, and it was basically about a 96% success rate. And the studies we performed at MIT clearly indicated that the success rate was most likely zero. Zero being defined as no evidence at all that even a single Scud warhead was destroyed by the action of Patriot against Scuds.
And as we see in the current situation, I know that before Turkey turned us down for deployment, they were looking at trying to deploy more Patriot missiles in that area. Have they done any updates on the Patriot since then?
Well, they have done updates on the Patriot, but the particular updates that they've done will have essentially no effect on the ability of the Patriot PAC-2 interceptor. That's to say, there are two kinds of interceptors the system uses, a PAC-2 and a PAC-3. And the updates on the PAC-2 interceptor will have essentially no effect on improving its capability to intercept long-range Scuds of the kind that were used against Israel and Saudi Arabia in the Gulf War of 91. It might have some capability against shorter-range ballistic missiles, but even if it does, those shorter-range ballistic missiles are irrelevant because any of the missiles that are used to attack Israel will certainly be long-range. They will have to be long-range. So the PAC-2 won't make a difference. The PAC-3, which my current understanding is not deployed at all in Israel, but is being deployed in small numbers in Kuwait, does have more capability. But I don't believe, if I had to guess, and incidentally, everyone has to guess because it's never been tested against the Scud missile, which is amazing when one thinks about it. The PAC-3 was developed in order to deal with Scud missiles because the PAC-2 had failed, although they don't admit that, and they still never tested it against a Scud missile. So nobody knows how well it will do against the Scud. But my guess is the PAC-3 might have a slightly higher chance of intercepting shorter-range Scuds and shorter-range ballistic missiles, but it will have a difficult time against the Al Hussein, the longer-range missile. On the upside is, my guess is that there will be very few Al Hussein missiles available to the Iraqis to fire at either Kuwait or Israel. That guess could be wrong, we'll find out, but my guess is that there won't be a large number of them available to Saddam. Also, the likelihood that these Scuds could kill a large number of people is low. As long as there is warning that a Scud has been launched and some information about where it is going and people take shelter, then unless you're unlucky enough to be at the place where the warhead lands on top of you, you will almost certainly be able to survive an attack from these Scuds. So we know this from Israel, where these Scuds literally did things like land in the middle of a yard where large high-rise buildings ringed the yard, and you know there were people shaken up, but nobody was killed. Now, if a Scud warhead happened to hit the roof of the building, one of these high-rise buildings, and then penetrated in and exploded, it might have brought the building down, in which case there would have been large numbers of deaths and certainly casualties. But the only incidents of that which occurred in the Gulf War was the Ministry of Education building in Riyadh, which was where a Scud warhead actually went through the roof of the building. This was a big steel and concrete building, and the whole building came down. But that attack occurred at night, and there was only one or two people in the building who were unfortunate enough to be caught there. So I think if you ask what is the potential lethality of these missiles, given that there will be warning that they're launched and people can take cover, my expectation is the casualties will not be high.
Moving forward, sticking with the subject of missile defense and you being the focal point of some public controversy,
yes.
In May of 2000, you sent a letter to the White House.
Yes.
Which amounted to pretty much saying that there was some fraud within elements of the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, what happened is there was a heroic whistleblower, Neera Schwartz is her name. She was at TRW, a defense contractor, and she was asked to help develop a technique for determining whether an object seen at a great distance by a telescope, in this case a telescope on a kill vehicle that's supposed to intercept warheads, be able to look at the signal from each of these different objects and then determine which object was a warhead and which were decoys. And not surprisingly, she found that the software that TRW was developing didn't work. In fact, we now know that although the software could only work under very, very specialized conditions which have nothing to do with combat, it now turns out that the contractor, in this case TRW and Boeing, the company which at that time owned TRW, had concealed the fact that the experiment produced no usable data. That is to say, the sensor produced no data that could be used even if the software caused the sensor to be extremely noisy and to have lost what is called calibration. And at the time I wrote the White House in May of 2000, I was only aware of what was clearly fraudulent manipulation of the software. And later on, as I pursued the matter, I found out several very interesting things. First, it turned out that the experiment could not possibly have produced what they claimed because the sensor did not work. So that, of course, emphasizes the fact that fraud had occurred. Secondly, I found out that my university, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, was involved in covering up the fact that the sensor had failed and that the experiment was fraudulently represented to the Congress and the American people. I've been pursuing the matter with MIT for about 2 years now. I've been unable to get a response from the MIT Corporation, which has been fully informed repeatedly about what now appears to have been a criminal action on the part of the MIT researchers. And to explain why it was criminal, let me just give you a little bit of background. What happened is the federal investigators believed that they had evidence of fraud at this defense contractor, TRW, and they went to MIT Lincoln Laboratory, which is a big federally funded research laboratory that is run by MIT for the United States government. And Lincoln Laboratory was supposed to be an independent reviewer of this data. In fact, Lincoln Laboratory was created by law to be an independent reviewer for the government. And it turns out that the people who did the review for the federal investigators misled the federal investigators and concealed the fact that the sensor had not worked from the federal investigators, who at that time did not know that the sensor had failed. And there is documented evidence that the researchers at MIT knew that the sensor had failed. So this was not error. This was cover-up. And of course, since the people at MIT were supporting federal investigators, this means that they misled and concealed information from federal investigators, which is obstruction of justice, which is a felony. This has been an issue that I have been, writing to. In fact, I make sure that I write to get it all documented to the president of MIT, Charles Vest, and to the chair of MIT's corporation, Alex Darbaloff. And I've repeatedly been writing them and been unable to get a serious response from them. So I'm beginning to talk with members of Congress now, and I've been providing the Congress with documentation to support what I just told you, and there's plenty of documentation to support this. And so it looks like the fraud in the missile defense program is now involved a major research university being involved in covering up the fraud.
And in addition to MIT's stonewalling you so far, weren't they cooperating with the government when they, for instance, visited your office, I believe, and tried to grab your documents?
Yeah, what happened is the Defense Security Service, writing on behalf of somebody in the Department of Defense, who I have been unable to identify in spite of Freedom of Information Act requests, claimed that MIT might have an obligation to the U.S. government to collect documents from my office that the government claimed I had no right to have because they operate Lincoln Laboratory, the same laboratory that was involved in this fraudulent cover-up. And the president of MIT, Mr. Vest, who's mostly interested by every measure I can take in satisfying people in Washington and is not especially concerned about issues of academic freedom or integrity, he had MIT's legal counsel call me and explain to me what they were going to do to pick up these materials. And I told MIT's legal counsel, his name is Jeffrey Swope, works for Palmer and Dodge, a big corporate law firm that MIT uses for its legal support, that if he stepped into my office, he'd be in court the next day. And This got into the newspapers, and Vest has since backed away. But when I filed a complaint against the president of MIT with the MIT Corporation, they found that there was no problem in the president's behavior because basically he was involved in secret negotiations with the government on my behalf when this occurred. And the fact that no charges were brought against me, according to the MIT Corporation, is proof that his secret negotiations had succeeded, which, of course, is ridiculous. This is something that even in the old Soviet Union people would laugh at. So there's a real problem with the leadership at MIT, both being involved in covering up serious fraud that is probably criminal violations in the research that is federally funded at MIT, and also being involved in a pretty heavy-handed effort to intimidate a faculty member. And I'm pursuing this.
So were you surprised by MIT's current stance on this? Because it seems that universities in general appear to be moving more and more towards these partnerships with large corporations and more interested in keeping that money flowing in than really pursuing, you know, academic ideals.
Well, it's clear that the corporation of MIT knows or should know that there's strong evidence of criminal violations in the research that the U.S. government has been funding at MIT. It's absolutely clear. It's been written about now in the New York Times. I have provided the Congress with information about this. The people in the Congress who have been reviewing it have essentially no questions about the accuracy of the information I have provided to them. So in the case of the MIT Corporation, which I include the Board of Trustees who have been informed about this, it looks like we have an Enron-like situation where nobody wants to accept the fact that there's something seriously wrong, in fact, something that could well be criminal. And literally, there's nobody in a position of authority who seems to recognize they have a public responsibility. So I think the situation at MIT is very serious, and it bodes ill for the leadership of all of the great research universities, because I think eventually we're going to see a congressional reaction to this behavior. People in Congress are watching, and it's clear that MIT's current strategy is to stonewall and do what we call the slow roll, that is to say, delay, 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 in the hope that people will lose interest. But I actually think that's going to backfire on them big.
All right, stepping back to get a little bit bigger picture of what you see wrong with our current direction in national missile defense, we're looking at they're currently deploying or saying they are a system up in Alaska. We've got recent news here, at least in Seattle, where they announced on the front page that North Korea could hit us with nuclear missiles.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's what's being said, but that's ridiculous, but go ahead.
So yeah. Tell us about why our NMD program should be changed.
Well, the current National Missile Defense Program tries to intercept warheads at very high altitudes in space where everything is operating in a near vacuum. And in the near vacuum of space, a feather and a rock will travel along together because there's no aerodynamic drag to cause the feather to slow up relative to the rock, which means that if I just simply inflate a balloon, a very light balloon, in the shape of a warhead, it can be easily made indistinguishable from the warhead, even though it's very light, and I can make enormous numbers of these balloons. So what that basically means is that an adversary can build decoys or disguise the warhead very easily, again, because of the near vacuum of space. So, to give you an example, I could just inflate a spherical balloon, and then I could inflate a spherical balloon around a warhead. So everything looks like spherical balloons. So there are all kinds of tricks of this kind which are technologically very undemanding and would easily defeat the system, the current missile defense system, because it's basically trying to see what's a warhead and what's a decoy by looking with a telescope. So the kill vehicle, the vehicle that's supposed to hit the warhead and destroy it, is basically a telescope that is launched to very high velocity, about 8 or 8.5 kilometers per second, toward the complex of targets that would be decoys and warheads. And when the kill vehicle is maybe 60 seconds prior to attempting to intercept, it's maybe 600 or 700 kilometers away, because the closing speed is 10 or 15 kilometers per second between the warheads and decoys and the kill vehicle. So 60 seconds before you actually have to fly into the warhead, you're 600 to 900 kilometers away. Well, when you look through this telescope, all you see are pinpoints of light, and you'll have no time to, you can't see any shape and you can't see anything but the brightness of each object, and you can also see a change in the brightness of each object, because if the object is not symmetrical and it's tumbling, sometimes it'll be brighter and sometimes it'll be less bright because it'll be oriented side on or nose on. But that's all you can observe, and the brightness of the object and the fluctuation in brightness, the shape of the object, is very easy to emulate with a balloon. So basically, if you're going to believe that this system has a chance to work, you have to believe that you have an adversary out there who can build ICBMs, nuclear warheads, but can't figure out how to deploy a balloon that's no more complex than the Mylar balloons you see in a zoo. And that's ridiculous to expect that.
And yet in the media, every, I don't know, 4 to 6 months, we see reports of another U.S. test that, if you didn't know any better, you'd get the impression that they're slowly, successfully working out the bugs in the system.
Yeah, the tests are totally irrelevant to the final performance of the system. I can give you a very simple analogy of what they're doing and why their claims are misleading. What they're doing essentially is showing that they can hit an isolated object, that they know exactly where it is and when it's going to be where it is. So it's the equivalent of me taking a very well-aligned, high-powered rifle, putting it on a tripod, and then suspending from a tree an apple at some large range, and then adjusting the rifle very carefully, and then firing the rifle and showing you that I could hit the apple from very long range. So that's one test, and that by itself indicates that you have the ability, under very controlled conditions, to align the rifle and shoot the apple. Now, that does not mean that you would then be able to have, let's say, for example, somebody in the woods, somewhere in the clearing where you did this experiment, throw a garbage can full of apples into the air, and you would then be able to select the right apple, turn the gun fast enough, and hit the right apple, not getting any of the other apples that were decoys. That's a completely different situation, and in fact, that's the situation you would face, not the situation where the enemy stands in front of you, polishes the markings on their body so that you can shoot at them, and then waits for you to align the rifle and shoot them. That's a different situation from what you would actually see in combat.
So do you think, then, it's folly to be pursuing this system at all?
I think this system holds out no hope that it will ever work. So we're not talking about a system, as Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld claims, we'll experiment a little with and we'll adjust a bit. It will never work. It has no chance of working because the fundamental science is not there. What this system is effectively trying to do is find suitcases at an airport that might have bombs inside it by simply looking at the suitcases with eyes at a distance. So it's the equivalent of me taking 20 suitcases, putting them out in front of you at an airport, You can't pick them up. You can't let a dog sniff it. You can't x-ray them. But you can use your eyes and inspect them. And by inspecting them with your eyes, you're asked to find the suitcase that has the bomb inside it. Well, that's never going to be successful because when you look with your eyes, all you see is the surface of the suitcase, which has nothing to do with what's inside it. And since there's no ability for this system to ever look inside the suitcases that are out there, in this case the warheads and decoys, there's no chance it will ever work.
I'm wondering if we could jump over to current news with the recent space shuttle disaster.
Yes.
Do you see parallels between what happened there and some of our military weapons pursuits?
Well, I think there's a parallel that, from my point of view, is cultural. And cultural in this respect, I mean the culture of NASA. We had this awful accident and lost the crew of the Columbia, but it's not at all clear to me that this had to happen. That is to say, the loss of life had to happen. And part of this has to do with the mythology that NASA tries to propagate to the public and the belief system that builds up within NASA with regard to their own propaganda. So let me give you specifics with regard to the shuttle. The orbiter was not put into an orbit where it could maneuver to the space station. Now, I don't understand why we have a space station where NASA claims you can do all kinds of things that with humans that robots can't do, if they didn't think of planning the mission so that the shuttle vehicle could fly in an orbit close enough to rendezvous with the space station if there was a problem. They just didn't do it. The shuttle did not have a robot arm operating on it. I'm sure, I know why the robot arm would have been taken off or not used, because this shuttle couldn't carry adequate weight to orbit for what they were planning on this mission. That's another false claim that NASA has propagated, that the shuttle is the best heavy lift vehicle for getting large payloads into space that has yet been built by the United States. That's false. The shuttle payloads are very marginal relative to the size of the shuttle. And by not having a robot arm on the shuttle, they had no possibility of an emergency resupply of the shuttle if they had identified that there was a problem with the heat shield. So, for example, they were 16 days in orbit, and during those 16 days, the Russians were preparing a robot vehicle that was going to be launched and would dock with the space station. There is no reason why that vehicle couldn't have been refurbished if NASA had made the effort to understand whether or not the heat shield had really been damaged and told the Russians early enough to change their mission. But, of course, if this robot vehicle, which was capable of docking with the space station, was not capable of moving close enough to the shuttle, the question is why? I mean, we have had 20 years of space operations. We're supposedly in a program cooperating with the Russians, and nobody has thought about the contingency where somebody needs to get something in an emergency situation up to the shuttle. And we know that reentry is one of the big problems. From the first day we flew the shuttle, the Russians have lost two crews in two different accidents related to reentry in 67 and 71. We should have lost the Apollo 13 crew in reentry, but we were lucky enough that the skill of the people in NASA at that time and the skill of the crew saved them, and that's a wonderful thing that happened, but the odds were against them. And we put this shuttle into orbit, and the attitude of Mr. Ditmore, the program manager, was, well, once they're in orbit, there's nothing we could do. Well, that's like taking off to fly the Pacific, and you didn't do anything to check whether or not your fuel was adequate, and you're halfway across, and you don't have fuel to get back or to go forward. And you say to yourself, well, there's nothing more for me to do. Well, the time to do things is planning the flight and checking things out before you fly, not once you're up there. And I think what's happened in the case of the shuttle is we have a gigantic failure, and I do mean gigantic, because the whole organization had lulled itself into the idea that you're flying into space like a bus. You know, it's a shuttle. They even call it a shuttle, like you're just shuttling back and forth to space. Well, that's not the case. And if you become the victim of your own propaganda, what you do is you don't make contingency plans that anybody who was serious about putting people into space and getting them down alive would be doing, because this is a very dangerous activity. So I regard this recent accident, just like the Challenger accident before it, as almost certainly avoidable. That we might have lost people and other things, but this was not a situation where we should have lost that crew, in my view.
Was there a serious overhaul of how NASA does things after the Challenger disaster?
Well, they claimed there was a serious overhaul, but it's pretty clear that nothing substantive was done. Because if I were sitting, you know, senior engineer in NASA and planning a launch of the kind that the Columbia was doing, an experiment or a flight of the kind that Columbia was doing, I would have been asking myself, what are our recovery options from day one when we start planning the mission? Day 500, a year and a half or 2 years later, is not the time to ask what problems do we have and why we can't recover from them. So day one, you should be saying to yourself, okay, if we go to orbit and there's some problem with the heat shield, something we have been concerned about for 20 years, how would we recover the crew? Well, maybe the Russians or even we will have a launch vehicle, a robot launch vehicle available that we can put something up to resupply the crew, even if they have to sit in space until we can get something else to them. What provisions should we make to be able to get to the shuttle and have the shuttle crew be able to grab these materials, extra life support materials, for example? That's not been done. 1986 was the Challenger accident, and nothing's been done along those lines. Shouldn't we co-orbit the shuttle close enough to the space station that if there's a problem, we can get the crew to the space station? Wasn't done. Shouldn't we make sure the robotic arm is on the space shuttle? Because if something happens, you may need the robotic arm to position the vehicle near the space station if you need to, or to be able to pull in a payload that rendezvous with you. There was no robotic arm on the shuttle. We've had all these missions where we claim to be working to have people doing spacewalks so that people can go out and do repairs or construction in space. Nobody in the shuttle crew was qualified to do a spacewalk to check what was going on. All of this is hard to believe, that you would have an experiment planned with such a low priority toward saving the crew if one of these things, like a heat shield problem, occur. A problem that was well known literally from the first day Columbia flew. So I think there's something very seriously wrong at NASA, and I think the Challenger accident did not teach them a thing.
So what mechanisms are there for fixing situations like this? I know you had previously mentioned with your MIT situation that Congress was going to get wind, and you felt confident in that, but looking at, for instance, the fact that we have a new level of Patriot missiles out in the Gulf region now that don't appear to be any better than the first ones. We're looking at a national missile defense system that's moving forward that doesn't appear that it's going to work. We got NASA, you know, doing this stuff. Multiple disasters that don't appear to be being fixed. What's a country to do?
Well, that's a very serious question, which I honestly don't know how to answer. I can tell you that I've asked myself that question many times, and I am increasingly concerned about the lack of seriousness and oversight in both our military and our civilian high technology enterprises. And a lot of this Not all of it. This is a very complex problem. It's related to ideology. That is to say, people making false claims that are based on their some belief system they've developed, which may or may not have anything to do with reality. Whether it's, oh, the shuttle is a bus, you just get on it and ride into space, or whether it's, oh, if we just spend enough money on missile defense, we'll be able to do it. Or if, gee whiz, if I jump off this building, I should be able to figure out between the time I jump off and hit the ground how to fly. I mean, it's just it's an attitude. And these attitudes are not only part of the American electorate is not sufficiently aware of them, or the possibility of changing the cultures is very remote. The culture of NASA, for example, how do you change a gigantic organization that's developed this attitude? So I don't know what the answer is, but I do think if people somehow do not become more sensitive to these very serious and fundamental problems in the development of high technology, both in terms of weapons as well as activities in space, we're going to just continue to have these accidents, and sooner or later some of them are going to be gigantic, like a missile defense that fails when we're under attack. So there really needs to be a higher regard for the technical realities that science provides us with. That means we have capabilities. Science gives us capabilities, but science also points to limitations. And you need to know what the science is about to understand how you can exploit the science and where the science will not allow you to exploit it. And we don't have decision makers in government who are either capable or, for that matter, interested in looking at these problems in these terms.
And what would you recommend to your average citizen, to our listeners? I think a lot of people hear your words and they feel that, well, I'm not, you know, an MIT professor and know physics inside and out. How am I to weigh in on something like this and steer us towards a more sane course?
I can only give a general answer since nobody listens to me. That's my joke with my colleagues. I think the fundamental social and political thing that all Americans can understand and work on is to demand full transparency and to demand full accountability for things that happen. Something was wrong at NASA. I'm not interested in a witch hunt, but somebody or some group of people, possibly even large, were responsible for this lack of attention to safety. I'm not talking about dragging them up on criminal charges or whatever, but people need to be held accountable, and people should demand that these decision makers tell the truth. And if they're caught lying, severe consequences should occur. I think that should be just an absolute given for anything, whether it's the police chief in San Francisco. If he's found to have lied, he should, frankly, go to jail. Or whether it's people in NASA, or whether it's the corporate directors of MIT. You know, if it's MIT's president, can't prove that he didn't know about this, and he can't prove it, and he's been involved in concealing evidence of criminal activities at MIT, he should be charged. He should be indicted. And there shouldn't be any secret trials. Everything should be transparent. And once people understand, you know, make that demand, which I think is unlikely, incidentally, but I think that's the recipe, then it will be possible to uncover many of these fundamental problems, because there are many responsible people inside all of these systems who are trying to do the right thing. We're learning that at NASA now. We see all these emails from these frustrated engineers who are trying to get decision makers' attention, and were basically either being ignored or no mechanism was set up for them to be able to reach the decision makers. These are people who were trying to do their job. They're honest people. They have integrity. They're not responsible for this problem. The people who were in charge, who weren't listening, who didn't care, who were involved in propagandizing and making false statements, they're responsible. So democracy can't function. This is that fundamental. Democracy can't function if there isn't transparency in the way our organizations function, and if there isn't accountability when people either break the law or do not meet their responsibilities. And I think people should demand that.